The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. or call 919-875-8889. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 2/August 9, 2021. It's another double issue. It's, as usual, the front cover is bordered in red, with Time in large white block lettering superimposed upon the art or illustration for this edition. Time is barely readable because it's superimposed upon lighter colors. Rethinking Work is the headline. There are 9.2 million open jobs. Why nobody wants them? And the illustrative collage that appears is in a grid pattern, five across and five down. Photos of things that signage, really, it's signage. It says, now hiring, we need all staff, hiring now, help wanted kitchen. And here's something in Spanish, say, necesita ayudante de cocina. Help wanted, now hiring, help wanted, we are hiring, apply now. Now hiring, help needed, help wanted, apply within. We're hiring, don't call us, low pay. Help wanted servers, now hiring, sign on bonus. We're hiring, join us. Help wanted, and most of these are fairly mundane. They're signs hanging on windows or doors, or one is a big badge on another person's shirt. One is an app on a phone. A couple look like blackboards positioned outside businesses. But here's one that says just simply, help wanted. And the sign is taped on the front of a donut case. So there's help wanted at the donut shop. Beginning now with brief news, the brief news. Two short articles here, and then three very short articles from the news ticker. The brief news, good question. Will Texas Democrats' great escape impact the voting rights fight? By Sonia Mansour, with reporting by Janelle Ross. Close to 60 Democrats in the Texas House flew to Washington, D.C. July 12 to stall the passage of two GOP-backed bills that would restrict access to voting across the state. As of July 21, the lawmakers remained in the Capitol, having met with Vice President Kamala Harris and members of Congress to spotlight the flood of restrictive GOP-sponsored voting bills nationwide and to urge congressional action to combat them. We are holding the line, State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher tells Time. If Republicans are silencing our voices here in Texas, they will do it anywhere in America. The lawmakers' plan hit a snag when six tested positive for COVID-19 after arriving in D.C., forcing the group to isolate. Among them is Representative Celia Israel, who had planned to get married July 15 before her plans were derailed. I hope this instance highlights the sacrifices we're willing to make for the cause of democracy, Israel said in a July 17 statement. The Texas voting bills would empower partisan poll watchers, ban drive-through and 24-hour voting, as well as drop boxes for mail ballots, and bar local election officials from sending out vote-by-mail applications to voters unless they're explicitly requested. Without the House Democrats present, the state's legislature, which is in a special session, no longer has the quorum required to pass the bills, which Republicans say will help ensure election integrity. Texas Democrats took the nuclear option by leaving en masse, says Brandon Rottinghaus, a political science professor at the University of Houston. But Texas Republicans can continue their legislative blitzkrieg after they wear the Democrats down, he adds. They can't stay away forever. Governor Greg Abbott, who says the Democrats' decision inflicts harm on the very Texans who elected them to serve, can continue to call as many special sessions as he wants or needs. President Joe Biden gave a July 13 speech on the importance of protecting voting rights, but he did not address the Senate filibuster, which currently stands in the way of passing federal voting legislation to counter the recent wave of states' restrictive voting laws. The omission irked progressives calling for decisive action. Elected officials in Texas are now literally fleeing the state and avoiding arrest to protect voting rights, says James Slattery, an attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project. Isn't the most minimal thing that U.S. senators can do is kill the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation? Texas Democrats have said they plan to stay in Washington at least until the current special session ends in August. I've got the largest suitcase I have in my house, Fisher says, and I threw in extra socks. Moving to the second short article, subtitled Health, a fourth COVID-19 wave is brewing in the U.S. In the first half of July, the number of new daily COVID-19 cases across America nearly tripled, from 13,700 July 6 to more than 37,000 July 20. It is a surge that harbors grim reminders of past waves in the summer and fall of 2020, but also one that looks significantly different from those we've seen before. Even at its worst heights, the pandemic has never struck the U.S. uniformly. Instead, it wandered from urban areas to suburban and rural counties, and then back again. The map, which I shall describe momentarily, shows the 14-day growth in cases per 100,000 residents at the county level, capturing in finer detail the variations in completed vaccination rates per state. Alabama has vaccinated just 33.9% of residents as of July 21, for example, compared with nearly 70% in Vermont. The per capita rate of new cases clusters in regions where a majority of adults remain unvaccinated, and those case rates are contingent on the number of people being tested for COVID-19, figures that can only underestimate the true picture, written by Chris Wilson. Now, here's the little map that's referred to, titled COVID-19 Hotspots in the Past 2 Weeks, Total Cases per 100,000 Residents. There's a map of the United States, including the extension maps of Alaska and Hawaii, and it's in brown. And superimposed upon the brown map are dots or blobs. A white dot or blob signifies 0 to 249 total cases in the past 2 weeks per 100,000 residents. A rosy colored dot or blob indicates 250 to 499. A red, or rather a rouge red, indicates 500 to 999, and a bright red, 1,000 plus. Now, it's hard for me to differentiate those colors of red because the map is small, but I can see blobs of red, and the biggest blobs of red are in south, western Missouri, northwestern Arkansas, further south in Arkansas, and in northeastern Louisiana. Also, in northeastern Florida, probably the Jacksonville area. Now, the New England states are all brown. I don't see any white dots or red blobs there. Likewise, the Dakotas and Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and most of Michigan. Scattered throughout the western states are the white and rose-colored dots. No blobs there. However, in Colorado, there are red blobs, not as big as the others that I just noted, but there are a few red blobs in far northwestern Colorado and far southern Colorado. Also in the very northern tip of Texas and in the very southern and southwestern areas of Texas. Some in Iowa, a few white or beige rose in eastern Kansas, and then scattered throughout those states from the Great Lakes downward to the Gulf of Mexico, but nothing blobby until that northeastern Florida section. North Carolina is not red blobbed at all on this map, remembering, of course, that this was published probably not yesterday. But in North Carolina is scattered with little dots of the white and the pale rose. Likewise, Virginia and South Carolina and Tennessee. Kentucky has a few more, but they're not bright red. And then further north, it looks pretty clear, that is in terms of being brown, like the background of the map. Now for the news ticker, and these are short items. England lifts COVID-19 restrictions. England has lifted almost all lockdown restrictions and mask mandates, declaring July 19 Freedom Day, despite recent spikes in new COVID-19 cases. Scientists have criticized the reopening, however, arguing the risks are still high, particularly for younger, unvaccinated individuals. Ben and Jerry's boycott draws Israel's anger. Ben and Jerry's said July 19, it is inconsistent with our values for its ice cream to be sold in occupied Palestinian territory. Israel is now pressuring the U.S. to enforce anti-boycott laws against the company and has warned parent company Unilever of severe consequences. Socialist wins Peru presidency. Pedro Castillo, a teachers' union activist who's never held public office, was officially declared winner of Peru's presidential elections July 19, beating right-wing candidate Keiko Fujimori. Castillo's pledge to rewrite the country's constitution and tackle income inequality. Wage Rage by Alana Samuels. Work in progress. Zhu Vong had long known his job de-icing planes, loading bags, and chocking wheels at the Missoula airport was dangerous, especially in Montana winter, when blinding snow and rain obscure the spinning engines that can suck in a human body. But this past winter, conditions at UNIFI, which services planes for United and Delta, became intolerable. Because of the pandemic, understaffing was so bad that Vong was simultaneously handling two or three planes on the ramp or tarmac while making sure new trainees did not get inhaled into the engines. Now, Vong is spelled V-A-N-G, and Zhu is X-U-E. One day, Vong's colleague, Jared Bonney, was complaining. He'd been promised a raise for years that never materialized. I was like, join the club, Vong recalls. Bonney's pay was capped at $10.40 an hour. Vong, whose job was more senior, was capped at $11.50. Single adults would need to make $14.13 an hour to support themselves in Missoula, according to MIT's living wage calculator. Other UNIFI, that's UNIFI, workers started sharing complaints about low pay, lousy conditions, and broken promises of raises, even though their jobs required specialized training and were critical to flight safety. A walkout could get them fired. UNIFI was not unionized, and plans for one 3 years earlier had fizzled. But in April, when Bonnie says a UNIFI HR manager called the workers unskilled and undeserving of more money, getting fired didn't seem so bad. Not when Panda Express and Taco Bell were posting job openings starting around $14 an hour. It was just a boiling point for me, says Bonnie, 25, who could not save money after paying his bills, even while living with his parents. The strike happened on a cold Monday in April. 6 of the 15 workers who had vowed to participate, including Bonnie and Vong, showed up for their 4 a.m. shift and clocked in with the intention of telling their supervisor they were staging a walkout. They were met by the regional manager, who had been alerted to their plans by one of their colleagues. Rather than grounding flights, the workers had their badges confiscated. Undeterred, they regrouped in the baggage area, then went to Target to get supplies to make picket signs. For the rest of the week, they and two other workers who had missed the initial walkout picketed outside the airport. Within 2 weeks, all had been fired. Vong has no regrets. I hope we spark something, he says. We want this movement to keep going. People deserve a living wage. UNIFI did not return multiple emails and calls seeking comment. The pandemic was a breaking point for low-wage workers like Bonnie and Vong, who are fed up with being treated poorly while barely making enough to get by. Over the past 40 years, while wages have soared for higher-income workers, they've barely budged for people at the bottom of the income scale. From 1979 to 2019, wages for the lowest-paid decile of workers rose 3.3% when adjusted for inflation, while wages for the top 5% of workers rose 63.2%, according to the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank. Over that time, as middle-class jobs were automated or sent overseas, and as more people vied for what was left in the wake of the 2001 and 2007 to 2009 recessions, employers had the upper hand. By one estimate, 53 million people, around 44% of U.S. workers, were at low wage before the pandemic, making an average of $10.22 an hour. But after 17 months of having to show up to jobs in person, putting their lives on the line while white-collar and knowledge workers stayed home and saw their savings grow, America's hourly workers may be gaining leverage. Entire shifts of employees at fast food restaurants, amusement parks, and airports are walking off their jobs, pasting handwritten notes on the doors that say, "We quit." In Worcester, Massachusetts, more than 700 nurses have been on strike since March 8, protesting working conditions and reduced staffing, as their parent company, Tenet Healthcare, posted a large profit during the pandemic. Frito-Lay workers in Kansas went on strike July 5 to protest low wages and 84-hour work weeks, and Volvo employees in Virginia went on strike in April and again in July, calling for wage increases and signing bonuses. Farm workers in California are walking off the job to demand higher pay. Employers are being forced to raise wages and offer perks like college, tuition, and signing bonuses. What economists call the reservation wage for people without a college degree, the lowest pay people are willing to accept to take a job, rose 26% in March compared with the same time last year. It is too soon to tell if this is just a characteristic of an economy suddenly reopening and leaving employers scrambling for workers, or whether these changes will be permanent. There were signs, however, that workers were losing patience with years of low pay, even before the pandemic. The rock-bottom unemployment rate in November 2019, it hit 3.5%, the lowest in decades, gave them confidence to start pushing again. In 2019, there were more work stoppages involving 1,000 or more employees than in any other year since 2001. The federal minimum wage is just $7.25 an hour, and 20 states have not increased their minimum wage beyond that. All other states have either tied the minimum wage to inflation, which ensures it will keep rising as prices do, or increased it. Companies like Amazon and Costco announced as early as 2018 they were increasing pay for all U.S. employees to $15 and $14, respectively, a move that forced competitors to pay more, too. In March, Costco raised its starting wage to $16 an hour. The workforce was getting restless after years of stagnant wages and a decline in union representation that traditionally gave them a voice, says Thomas Kochan, a professor of work and employment research at MIT's Sloan School of Management. For low-wage workers, the pandemic demonstrated how much inequality there is. It's really leading them to ask, is this the kind of job I want, or should I leave? A century ago, widespread labor unrest led to an overhaul in the way workers were treated in America. At the turn of the 20th century, the U.S. had low unionization rates and few social benefits compared with other industrialized nations. But as labor shortages grew during World War I and inflation rose at the end of the war, workers began to revolt. In 1919, one-fifth of the nation's workforce participated in strikes, including the walkout of 350,000 steel workers. Determined to head off unionization and maintain some control of workers' lives, companies started to offer more benefits, figuring they could reduce turnover and increase productivity, says Joseph A. McCartan, a professor of history at Georgetown University. Employers were realizing it simply does not pay to treat workers like machinery that you are going to use up and throw out. When you do that, they organize, McCartan says. This ushered in an era of welfare capitalism in which companies offered benefits like pensions, apprenticeship programs, stock ownership, and health insurance. U.S. Steel, which had refused to shorten the 12-hour workday during the 1919 strike, reduced it to 8 hours in 1923. General Electric offered a pension plan and paid vacation for blue-collar workers. General Motors helped employees buy homes and set aside a portion of its profits for employee bonuses. Accidents decreased, productivity went up, turnover slowed. General Electric's turnover rate of 50% in the 1910s fell to half that by 1922. What happened a century ago might sound familiar. Some of today's biggest companies are announcing big pay and benefit increases to attract workers and reduce turnover. Since the pandemic began, Target said it would permanently raise the starting wage for U.S. employees to $15 an hour, a move that Best Buy followed. Beef producer JBS USA said in March it would start paying 2-year college tuition for its 66,000 workers and their dependent children. In April, National Garbage Collection and Recycling Company, Waste Management, said it would offer 36,000 full-time workers and their dependents free tuition for undergraduate and graduate degrees in partnership with Guild Education, which teams up with companies to offer educational benefits to employees. This is a reversal from what most employers have been doing over the past few decades, cutting back benefits, pushing more financial responsibilities onto workers. But as America ages, many companies are realizing that a big share of their employees are going to retire soon, and they might not be able to find enough people to replace them. The retirement rate of baby boomers shot up during the pandemic. It became apparent we needed to do something fundamentally different and radical to attract and retain talent, Tamla Oates-Forney, the chief people officer at Waste Management, told me. Even before the pandemic, demographic shifts were making it difficult for Waste Management to find the drivers and technicians they needed. Millennials and Gen Z workers were going into other industries, she says. Waste Management hopes that offering free education will attract people who may want to start out driving a truck and then work their way up in the company. It also added more money for backup child care for workers during the pandemic. Employees who do not feel their company offers advancement opportunities will leave for one that does. Sarah Stark, 20, started working at a Chipotle just north of Atlanta when she turned 16. As she kept working there for 2, then 3 years, she got just one raise worth 15 cents to add to her $10 an hour starting wage. I spent 3 years of my life there and nothing changed, she says. When Chipotle lost workers during the pandemic and Stark was pushed harder and harder, cleaning and sanitizing the restaurant with bleach by herself, she got fed up and quit in October. She soon found a job at Starbucks, which offered a college scholarship program, free mental health benefits, and opportunities for promotion. After just a few months, Stark was promoted to a managerial role, making $12.70. She plans to use Starbucks' online education program next year to go back to school and study design. The list of benefits Starbucks offered took up our whole training session, she says. In a statement to Time, Chipotle says it offers benefits like tuition reimbursement, mental health care, and a bonus program. As of May, its average pay was $15 an hour. Once they raise wages and offer benefits like free tuition, it will be difficult for companies to reverse them. Professional workers may be quitting their jobs en masse to go live their dreams, but the pandemic has also made low-wage workers take a step back and think about what they're doing with their work lives, says Rachel Carlson, CEO of Guild Education. The plurality of workers are saying, okay, $15 an hour, but what do I do all day? And is there a job after that for me? And where does it take me? She says. Career mobility is now the value proposition that matters for companies. Workers' increased leverage is already playing out in the job market. Wages have risen for three straight months, according to the most recent jobs report. They are a full 10% higher in the leisure and hospitality sector than they were 2 years ago. 764,000 workers in that industry quit in May alone. Some workers who walked away from bad jobs saw big pay bumps in their new positions. A month after Jared Bonney got fired from the Missoula airport, he went to a local casino to apply for a job. He was hired on the spot and promoted to assistant manager after a few months. His base wage is still low, $12 an hour, but he can make a lot of money in tips, he told me. On a good night, he'll make $23 an hour. Sandra Siebert, 48 was one of the 3,400 workers at a Smithfield meat plant in South Dakota who rejected the company's initial contract offer in June, saying they deserved a raise as food and gas prices increased. Workers have been quitting en masse, she says, as many as 50 a week, up from one or two a week before the pandemic. After workers rejected the initial contract, which would have altered break time and kept pay the same, the company offered a $1.75 raise, kept breaks the way workers wanted, and included a $520 bonus for them. Workers accepted. The course of negotiations was not unusual, Kira Lombardo, Smithfield's chief administrative officer, said in a statement. If Seibert and Bonnie are making more than they did before the pandemic, they are still far from middle class. Many workers who participated in walkouts or strikes over the past year, who switched jobs for higher wages, still may be struggling. They're squeezed by the highest apartment rental costs in more than 2 years and prices for consumer goods that climbed 5.4% a year ago, the biggest annual increase since 2008. Even with a raise, berry pickers in California who walked out will be making around $30,000 a year if they work full-time. Companies like Disney are offering $1,000 hiring bonuses, but housekeepers will still be making just $16 an hour if they take the jobs. That is the result of 4 decades of declining union power and a stagnant minimum wage. The idea that any short-run shortages that do exist would undo 40 years of employers' ability to suppress wages, it just does not ring true whatsoever, says Heidi Sheerholtz, a former Obama administration economist who works at the Economic Policy Institute. The labor movement saw further setbacks this year when an effort to organize an Amazon warehouse in Alabama failed and the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a California regulation that let union organizers meet with farm workers on farm property. Progressive groups say that the PRO Act, P-R-O, which passed the House in March and would make it easier for workers to organize, is what is needed to help employees gain more power in the long term. Conservatives say people will be returning to jobs once all states end more generous additional unemployment benefits offered during the pandemic. Meanwhile, workers are seeking out the companies and industries that are giving raises alongside a path to better careers. Those companies are not having trouble filling positions. After it announced its educational benefit, Waste Management's May recruiting drive attracted 1,200 people. The company made 420 offers, and 70% of those people have started working for the company. More than half of applicants mentioned the free college tuition offer. As Zhui Vong is finding out, it can be hard to find work at companies that have decided to treat workers well. After Unifi fired him, it raised wages to keep the remaining workers on, but only to $11 an hour. Vong started applying for other jobs and got a few offers, but he has not accepted one yet. He wants to hold out for something better. He has his sights set on a full-time job with an airline rather than an airline contractor. A few of his former Unifi co-workers have gotten jobs at Alaska, where wages are higher, but Vong says the airline told him his timing was bad. It had just hired a flood of employees who had left jobs to work somewhere that paid more than the minimum wage. Here's a photo. This is Sandra Seibert, or Seibert. It's S-I-B-E-R-T, 48. Location, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Used to earn $17 per hour at a Smithfield meat plant, got a raise to $18.75 hourly. She's all dressed up for this photo. Indeed, it looks like a portrait. The background is blurry in shades of green and tan. She's a remarkably erect woman with a short cropped black hair, dark eyes, rose-colored lips, pearl earrings, pearl necklace, and dressed in an elegant-looking black dress with a rose-colored floral motif. More to items from the brief news. The first is a well-captioned photograph. The photo is basically dark. It has a dark background. It's a close-up of a man, but he looks red, and his helmet looks red, and his facial hair looks brownish red. And he's seated in front of a screen that has mostly midnight blue in the background with a red, what looks like explosion, in the center. Call to Duty is the caption in a photograph taken by Danish Siddiqui on July 11. A member of the Afghan Special Forces participates in a combat mission against the Taliban in Afghanistan's Kandahar province. 5 days later, the 38-year-old Siddiqui, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist from India who had worked for Reuters for over a decade, was killed while covering another bout of fighting near the country's border with Pakistan. 33 journalists and other media workers have been killed in Afghanistan from 2018 to 2021, according to a UN report published last year. And that caption was written by Tara Law. Headlined World, Cuba protests highlight the role of the Internet and the U.S. And this short article is written by Vera Bergengruen. Chanting freedom and enough, thousands of Cubans marched July 11 in the island's largest anti-government protest in decades. The pandemic's impact on the state-run economy, already struggling under Trump-era sanctions, sparked the nation's worst food and medicine shortages in 25 years. Empty supermarket shelves, rising COVID-19 infections, and recent access to social media, where Cubans now openly share their outrage, all helped foment unprecedented protests against the communist regime. Online dissent. President Miguel Díaz-Canel quickly blamed the demonstrations on the U.S.'s policy of economic suffocation. Since then, police have erected checkpoints across Havana, and the government has restricted access to social media and messaging apps like WhatsApp and Facebook, highlighting the critical role Internet access played in the unrest. This could not have happened a few years ago, says Paul Hare, H-A-R-E, a former British ambassador to Cuba. Political priorities. The unrest puts a spotlight on the Biden administration's drawn-out review of U.S.-Cuba policy. Although Biden promised during his campaign to reverse the failed Trump policies of imposing hundreds of new sanctions and economic measures on the island, there was little indication a shift was in the works till the protests erupted. As of July 20, the Biden administration says it's reviewing an increase in embassy staff and creating a working group to reconsider remittances to the island. Quick fixes. Several prominent Republicans, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, have called for the administration to provide Internet access to Cubans, arguing this may be the key to finally bringing democracy to the island. Biden said he's reviewing whether the U.S. can do that, though experts warn it is not a long-term strategy in the face of Cuba's growing humanitarian crisis. Here's the news ticker with three brief items. More officials report Havana syndrome. The U.S. State Department is now vigorously investigating reports from 24 spies, diplomats, and other officials based in Vienna of symptoms, including headaches, vision issues, and vertigo, similar to those previously reported by U.S. officials in Havana. In 2016 and 2017, The New Yorker reported, July 16. U.S. life expectancy drops in 2020. Driven mostly by the COVID-19 pandemic, the average American's life expectancy fell by 1.5 years from 2019 to 2020, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced July 21. The decrease was especially pronounced among Black and Hispanic populations. Hungary's PM calls for vote on LGBTQ law. Prime Minister Viktor Orban proposed a referendum on a new law banning LGBTQ educational content July 21 to ask the Hungarian public if it supports the promotion of such materials. The European Parliament has labeled the law a gradual dismantling of fundamental rights. Here's the brief opener, subtitled Worlds, with the title reading, Floods Expose the West's Hubris, by Ciara Nugent. There's a double-fold colored photograph here on the left and the right. This looks like it was taken aerially. Left and the right, there are green fields. I can't determine what the crops are. The lens is too far above the ground. Then off to the right in the middle of the photo is a large yellow earth mover. And it's rolling around on brown ground like mud because there are deep tracks going in a half of an ellipsis. And in the middle of that is a pile of debris. It's a debris collection point set up in the German town of Rheinbach, July 17. Local residents visited the site to dump home furnishings ruined by the flooding. Pia Negro's family has lived in a castle in Erstadt in western Germany for 300 years. They've spent the past 30 years restoring it to its former glory, but they left it in minutes, July 15. Evacuating around 4 a.m. as the worst floods to hit the country in centuries rushed toward their home. We could not bring anything, not the very old furniture, not even photos that are highly emotional, just our phones, says Negro, 32. The castle's 40 inhabitants, including Negro's family and renters, had spent the previous day moving furniture to higher floors and went to bed that night once the rains stopped. But as they slept, muddy waters continued to rise in two nearby rivers. Soon after the residents evacuated, the castle and surrounding village were submerged almost entirely. What is left of the building remains inaccessible. Negro says, we are just in shock that something like this can happen to our home. Accustomed to a mild climate, rarely troubled by extremes of weather, many in northwestern Europe had not anticipated just how bad the floods would be. From July 14 to July 15, as much as 7 inches of rain fell on parts of the western German states, Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia, roughly double the normal rainfall for the whole of July, overwhelming riverbanks and sweeping away entire buildings. At least 170 people died in Germany and 31 in Belgium. Scores are missing. The German language has no words, I think, for the devastation, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said as she surveyed the damage in Schult, a village on the river Ahr. That's A-H-R. It will need them. As a result of climate factors and a lack of resources, developing countries have long borne the brunt of extreme weather events. In Madagascar, for example, the worst drought in 40 years is currently driving 400,000 people into famine. But the summer of 2021 is showing us nowhere is safe in the climate crisis era. In June, a village in western Canada briefly became one of the hottest places on Earth, just before 90% of it was destroyed by a wildfire. Days after the flooding in Europe, the Chinese province of Henan saw what officials called once-in-1,000-years rain, which flooded subway tunnels and drowned commuters. People in countries like Germany with robust governance and typically predictable weather are reeling from the loss of a sense of safety in the face of climate change. We live in a society that thinks it can control nature, and now people are feeling powerless against it, says Albi Rebke, an emergency chaplain deployed to counsel hundreds of survivors in North Rhine-Westphalia. We have to be afraid of water and fire, like our ancestors 40,000 years ago. That is very difficult for people to understand. Studies will need to be done to prove that Europe's heavy rains were a direct result of climate change. But scientists say it's safe to assume it made them worse. Warmer air can hold more moisture, 7% more, for every 1% centigrade increase in temperature. And Germany's average temperature has risen at least 1.5 centigrade since pre-industrial times. Another possible factor is the shrinking difference in temperature between the polar regions and the equator, which could weaken global air currents, allowing low-pressure systems like the one over Western Europe in mid-July to stay in place for a longer time. A similar effect may have helped trigger the heat dome over Western Canada and the U.S. Northwest at the end of June. With climate change, at some point an event which would have been just heavy rainfall without too much damage is suddenly a real catastrophic event, says Carson Haustein, a climate scientist at the Climate Service Center Germany, a research body. That threshold will simply be crossed more often. The death toll in Germany may have been made worse by a sense of complacency about the risks of extreme weather, experts say. July 12, German meteorologists warned of severe floods, and the National Flood System issued an alert. But many say regional and local authorities did not successfully communicate risks to the public. In at least 4 instances, people drowned in their basements, possibly while trying to save their belongings. Others died while trying to move their cars to higher ground. People thought, yeah, I guess it's going to rain a lot, but they don't know what that means, Haustein said. We have to get rid of this thought that somehow extreme and severe weather cannot impact us. This is the climate hubris we have going on in Europe. In terms of cutting emissions, Europe's leaders have done more than most to respond to climate change. In the same week the floods hit, the European Commission presented its plan to overhaul EU economies by 2030 to cut greenhouse gas emissions 55% compared with 1990 levels. Germans are more likely than other European citizens to consider climate action a top priority, according to regional polls. The country's Green Party was already projected to make significant gains in September elections, and the floods have thrust the climate to the center of the campaign. Analysts say that could help the Greens' candidate for chancellor, Annalena Baerbock, recover some lost ground in polls in recent weeks. Her main rival, Armin Laschet of Merkel's center-right party, is the governor of North Rhine-Westphalia. He may suffer if voters blame him for the state's lack of flood preparedness. Even the greenest governments and the most rapid emissions cuts will not be able to reverse the nascent destabilization of our climate. A certain amount of further warming is already baked into our future, since carbon dioxide lingers in the atmosphere for at least 300 years and will keep trapping more heat. Recent extremes are not a new normal, scientists say, but likely evidence of the end of any kind of normal or stable climate altogether. For that reason, experts say in the coming months, governments urgently need to widen their priorities to include adapting to climate instability. It is something developing countries in the global south have long known, but so far wealthier countries have dedicated just 5% of international climate finance to adaptation initiatives, despite a long-held pledge to split aid 50-50 between emissions cuts and adaptation. As world leaders gear up for COP26, a major UN climate summit in November, this summer's events may finally force wealthy countries to take adaptation seriously. This will mean preparing to deal with an inevitable increase in natural disasters. We need to reshape disaster management, Baerbock, the Green candidate for chancellor, told local media in July. And the federal government needs to take more responsibility for it. It will mean costly efforts to make homes, transport, and infrastructure much more resilient to heat, rain, and droughts. It may also mean expanding and formalizing our systems for cleaning up after disasters. At the very least, it means better warning systems and more public awareness that extreme weather is a real threat, whatever country you live in. Here's For the Record, quotes and information all about. It sends a message of total intimidation. Don't report. Don't tell the truth. Spoken by Swati Chaturvedi, an Indian investigative journalist whose phone was targeted in the Pegasus spyware hack that affected media figures, politicians, and activists in an interview with Time, published July 19. Cardboard beds are actually stronger than ones made of wood or steel. Airweave says this, a Japanese bedding company, in a July 20 statement clarifying cardboard beds at the Tokyo Olympics were not designed to prevent athletes from having sex, as had been speculated. Some of the stars I produced are actually made of garbage. Donald Trump, former U.S. president, in a July 15 statement attacking unnamed former aides who have participated in books about his administration. Good news of the week. A gingham pinafore, believed to have been worn by Judy Garland while filming The Wizard of Oz, was found at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., the university said July 9. 2. The number of Americans, a father and son, sent to prison July 19 for their role in the 2019 escape of former Nissan executive Carlos Ghosn from Japan, where he's wanted on charges of financial misconduct, he denies. As a society, we must dare to stop and ask ourselves why we want to exploit a resource, stated by Naja Nathanielson, perhaps, Greenland's Minister for Housing, Infrastructure, Mineral Resources, and Gender Equality. In a July 15 statement accompanying news, the country will be suspending all future plans for oil exploration in its territory. And that name is spelled N-A-A-J-A with the last name N-A-T-H-A-N-I-E-L-S-E-N. $73,499, the minimum cost of a ticket per person for a suite on a 132-night round-the-world cruise, scheduled to begin in January 2024. The voyage sold out entirely within hours of being made available for bookings, July 15. I'm writing this not as the prince I was born, but as the man I have become, Prince Harry stated in a July 19 statement announcing the 2022 publication of a definitive and wholly truthful memoir. Time now to read one entry in the World's Greatest Places 2021, according to Time. Zurich, culture you can bank on. Although known as a financial center, Zurich also ranks among the most livable cities in the world and boasts the highest concentration of creative industry companies in Switzerland. Its young creatives are revitalizing formerly industrial neighborhoods, like Districts 4 and 5 in the West. The opening of Bridge, a market and food hall with funky cafes and artisanal purveyors, complements nearby art galleries, including the Museum for Design, which hosts exhibitions on fashion and other aspects of design. Zurich's first capsule hotel, Green Marmot, offers an affordable and modern alternative to the ubiquity of five-star accommodations. And the extension of Kunsthaus, which will make it the country's largest art museum when it opens in October, is certain to cement the city's cultural bona fides. That was written by Michelle Tichea, T-C-H-E-A. And there is a photo here of some type of a gallery in the Kunsthaus with people milling around, about eight or nine, not masked. They're on hardwood floors. The walls are white. And the only installation visible in this camera depiction is that of a very tall, based upon the size of the people, I'm going to say about 9 feet by 6 feet. And it's a portrait of a woman. She has brown hair, brown eyes. She's wearing a scoop neck, black something, because it's cut off pretty much at the shoulders. She's looking at the camera without smiling, and she is set against a black backdrop. There will be more World's Greatest Places to read about because Time lists 100 of them in this magazine. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.